All right, so the next section I want to talk about some very practical applications. I'm going to give you some examples of how I use AI on a daily basis, some of which is good. Sometimes I will confess that there are times when I have heated arguments with ChatGPT. I try not to insult the large language model, even though it has no feelings, but I do get frustrated because it gets stuck sometimes. But I do find that there are some things that these capabilities can do that allow me to be way more productive in my job, which has science and writing and software development and those kind of things. I don't turn to AI, for any sort of emotional need or advice on, people or anything like that. Although I think it's a reasonable alternative to Googling for stuff. You say, well, what's the latest research on, whatever. But I do want to give you some examples on just practical ways that you could use AI on a daily basis. Some that I'll show that are probably not stuff that you want to use unless you're already doing computer, program or other things. But this is just an example, a list of things that I pulled a couple weeks ago, and they were things that I had asked ChatGPT for help with. And then I've got a couple of examples there. I'm always in the middle of planning some kind of workshop or meeting, not something like 800 people like this, but it'll have different lists of people who signed up for this or that. And so I have lately been using ChatGPT to just take two spreadsheets of people with phone numbers or email and like merge them together for me. Those of you who do this kind of thing, I didn't want to spend half an hour in Excel merging two lists of people. Another that I don't use this very often because I am usually pretty good at expressing myself in writing, but I have an example of a better way to write a letter. I like to cook, and a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, I had some gnocchi, I had some shrimp, and I'm like, hey, what's a good recipe? This is what I have, and came up with a pretty decent recipe. Right, so I showed you this example before, and so I thought, well, maybe if I ask it again, and maybe if I'm more precise, tell it more detail, tell it what's wrong with this one, maybe I'll get a better design. And actually, it just got worse from there. So this one, I get the idea of people have freezers that are like this, but I don't know how that ice and water dispenser is going to work laying on its side, and then we have these drawers that are 6 inches deep, and I'm thinking, I don't know how useful those would be. And it certainly doesn't look like this is 4 meters by 4 meters. So it still has some ways to go, but I would just caution you to say that this stuff gets better and better all the time. So this is interesting to see. It's 3 years ago, we were showing slides, a friend of mine was showing slides at an AI meeting that we were holding, an AI conference. And he was like, yeah, here's ChatGPT-2. And then 3 came out before ChatGPT came out. So here's their version 2 of the model. And here's, I prompt and I say, give me a recipe for beer. And it had this nutty sort of set of instructions that had let it cool on a cutting board for 10 minutes before serving. Which, if you've ever made beer, that's not really part of the recipe. And then that was a 7 billion parameter model. And then the 170 billion parameter model, or sorry, the 70 billion parameter model, GPT-4 today is 2 trillion. But then the another one, it actually gave a feasible recipe. You couldn't really follow it, but it was if you kind of knew how to make beer, you could kind of follow that recipe. So we're making fun of these language models. And here it is 2 years later, and people asking for advice on how to make better beer. So, and I'm asking for advice on how to make gnocchi and shrimp. So these get better very quickly. So my son really likes to write episodes of his favorite cartoons. And so I said, let's get ChatGPT to help us do an illustration. And it did this beautiful illustration. It was familiar with this character, Danny Phantom. And so he said, let's put, here's the scene. And and we gave it the script and we said, can you give us like a comic book framing of this? And we got this really nice, really nice artwork. Some limitations though are it doesn't really do dialogue, right? So I don't really know what it's saying here. It's certainly not English. But then we went back and we said, hey, great, but could you actually put the dialogue into those bubbles? And we learned that it really couldn't associate the picture with the dialogue because it used one tool to make the picture and another tool to make the dialogue. In fact, what you'd see if you just asked it for, I'll show you an example of asking for iterations of things, you could ask it for the very same thing twice and you'd get something completely different. And it's not going to remember one style to the next from one image to the next. So then this I thought was interesting. Please give me a 6-frame comic book page for a third grader of Jesus being baptized. And the artwork's pretty cool. You can see it picked up on the Western bias that Jesus was like a hippie, a white guy from California with brown hair and blue eyes. And again, the dialogue is not, it's actually better dialogue than the other one, but still we're not quite sure about the syntax or who Jessen is. And then I said, okay, well, I have a 4-year-old granddaughter. And so I said, make it with no words like for a 4-year-old. And here you really see the sort of stereotypes coming through. I'm not sure what's happening with Moses in the lower left, but Jesus went from like brown haired guy to this blonde haired guy after he was baptized. And I mean, I was baptized. I didn't turn blonde afterward. These are clips or these are scenes from like 30-second really amazing video clips that are prompted by a model called Sora, which is from the same company that does ChatGPT. The model was prompted by like 1 or 2 sentences and came out with this amazing video. Like, the one in the bottom right, the prompt was something like, 2 woolly mammoths charging through the snow. And you get this 30-second photorealistic video. So the capabilities, although it didn't do so good on kitchen design, the capability of this to generate content is really quite amazing. So as we're using AI, prompting, which is, the prompt is what you type in, prompting is really important for the AI to be useful to you. And it makes a huge difference in the quality that you get out of the AI system, to the degree that when I want to complain to my friends about the stupid thing that GPT did, like this morning I was fighting with ChatGPT about debugging this software, and then I finally like got to the point, I don't think I made a slide on this, but I would say, okay, this code gives us this error here, and would say, okay, well, this fixes it, give me more code, give me the same error. So finally I said, the code you just gave me is the same code that you gave me earlier that produced an error. This is a yes or no question. Am I right? And said, yes, I apologize. And so then I said, this is another yes or no question. Giving me the same code is not going to solve my problem. Yes or no? Yes, you're right. And so, I was tempted to complain to my friends, but part of the problem was also, how was I prompting the model? And is there a better way to prompt the model to get better results? So rather than kind of writing off the model, think about how to prompt it. And I want to just give you some ideas on this. So a few weeks ago, I wanted a world map of OECD countries, like 36 or so companies that are part of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. These are countries that have bilateral or they have agreements about the rule of law and intellectual property and other things. And so I said, well, give me a map with this. I changed it here, but with the OECD countries colored and the rest of them white. And it said, okay, fine, give me a list of countries. And so I went, looked up, and I got the list of countries. And then it gave me this. And I said, well, 2 problems. It's missing the United States. It turned out because I had put the United States, and it was looking for United States of America. So it's not smart enough to tell between those two. And that happens quite a bit. There's like a slight difference that it somehow doesn't catch. But also I said, I can't see the white countries, so this doesn't really give me a world map like I was expecting. So I said, how about you put lines around all the countries so I get what I was looking for. So this took several iterations, but I eventually got what I was looking for. And I think that's just me needing to be more to realize that the system is not, can't read my mind, and it's not as intuitive as, let's say, an admin administrative aide would be. You saw this slide before, and that bookshelf in the bottom left and the stack of papers, that took several iterations with ChatGPT, and eventually I got what I was looking for. It took about 5 minutes and gave me several, and I said, well, I want something that's not photorealistic, but more like a cartoon and kind of colorful. And so I was able to get that from that. This is an iterative process, but there's also a whole, there's a new kind of job you can get called prompt engineer. It really is like a programming language. It's natural language, but there's a way to get, there are ways to get the computer to do what you're looking for it to do by smarter prompting. So let's think about, how does ChatGPT take your prompt and send it into that model that I showed before? And you have a prompt like, what's the capital of France? And you would expect that any, you know, LLM that's worth its salt would know, oops, that's supposed to be Paris. This is me jet-lagged yesterday. I meant that to be Paris. So you'd think that would be the answer, and that would be good. But what happens when you write this prompt is it gets wrapped by the system before it goes through the AI model. And it'll have some instructions up front, and then it might have some contextual information that it wants you to add at the end. And so when I prompt it with what is the capital of France, then this thing called the controller or the orchestrator will wrap that with some pre-instructions like, you're an expert on geography, answer the concisely and accurately, include some interesting facts about the capital city. And now I get this output here. And so that before and after that wrapping there is a way that a chat engineer can make the model more useful for people. And so that gives it sort of its more friendly approach, but also, you know, kind of affects the personality, if you will, of the model. I was playing around this morning with the actual computer code, and this is why I was fighting with ChatGPT, because I had code that was very simple, and it turned out ChatGPT didn't have any information about changes in the specifications for this system calls I was using, the calls to API, to the calls to the software, because its training ended in December of 23. So I also finally got it to admit that it was giving me answers that were potentially 146 days out of date. But on the left-hand side, that system, you can see at the top, the system instructions, you're a helpful assistant that translates sentences. This is stuff that I wrote. So I told the model that, and then I said, now translate hello world in Italian. It says hello, and the answer is hello world, translates to ciao mondo in Italian. I go, okay, I wanted to play around with a different personality. So imagine you're a somewhat rude assistant that translates English sentence into Italian. Always answer, but add text to convey that you're slightly annoyed at having to answer it all. In other words, like, imagine that you're a New Yorker. I love New Yorkers, by the way, but they're just like very upfront. And so then the output was, fine. Hello world is Italian and ciao mondo. So I was kind of playing around with it. So you can kind of change the personality of the model by just giving it those kind of prompt instructions. Now, these are four examples here where you want, let's say you want ChatGPT to summarize something for you. It's helpful if you tell the model, it could be Bard, it could be Claude, it could be any of the models that are out there. If you tell the model more about what you're expecting, like the audience, for example. Last year, I prompted something similar like this. I said, I'm giving an introduction lecture on artificial intelligence, and I want to talk about a little bit of the history of AI. The audience is people who are basically, you know, college graduates or, you know, reasonably informed people. And so what are the key concepts I should make sure to include in my talk? And I found it gave me like 5 or 6 points. I found it very helpful. I didn't translate that into my talk, but it suggested things that I wouldn't have thought to include, and it didn't suggest things that I did decided I wanted to include, but I found it very helpful. And in that case, I was telling it the audience as well as the question I was trying to ask. So you can see providing advice or detailed explanation. The different ways that you can ask these questions will influence the kind of answer that you get. And again, these slides are available, so I won't read through all of those, but I want to show you one concept that we call chain of thought, which is, it turns out because the language model is predicting one word at a time, it can do a better job if you give it an example of what you're looking for and then have it follow that example, where it's essentially like, show your math. Because then as it's predicting, you know, the next word, it's got a lot more context to deal with, and it's more likely that next word will be correct. So in the left-hand side, I just give it a sample question and answer, and I'm just asking it for the answer for this, you know, third grade math problem, maybe second grade math problem. Cafeteria had 23 apples. If they used 20 to make lunch and bought six more, how many do they have? Answer is 27, which is wrong. If I give it an example where I add some things, where in this case, when in my sample question, I've added an explanation that says I'm kind of thinking out loud as I'm going through. And in this case, it gets it right. The answer is 9. So this chain of thought, in more elaborate ways, and this was an example of chain of thought where you're getting the AI model to talk about the steps that it's taking, and that gives it more information along the way to get a better prediction of what the next word will be, and ultimately to guess that the next most probable word is 9 instead of 27. Okay, so I showed you some computer code just a minute ago with the RUD translator. There are other ways to use models. So that was code that I was doing the chatbot controller piece explicitly. If I go into the web interface, then it's doing it for me. But in that sort of mode of taking the model and wrapping it with my own software, there are different ways that people are developing capabilities with AI. One is called retrieval augmented generation, or RAG. In this case, instead of that wrapping thing there, what happens is you build this database repository. You imagine like you have this repository of 27 translations of the Bible and 16 concordances and the entire history of Christianity Today magazine and a few other things in your document repository. Maybe you could train the model with all that, but maybe you don't want to, maybe it's too expensive to do that for you. So you have this database system, and then the prompt gets built by first doing a search through your database and trying to give more context to the model to give the answer. So these are different techniques that are used by people who are building AI products or by people who want to like get under the covers. And I realize that the small set of people who are computer scientists want to do that kind of work. But these kind of approaches are more of them are popping up every day. I'll talk about one that has to do with what are all called agents. But I mentioned before, part of what we hope will happen is that models will get smaller and still retain the capabilities that the large ones do. And now you can already on, again, I can't flip the screens here, but I have a piece of software on my laptop called LM Studio. And I can choose, remember that I said there was this Hugging Face site that had 600,000 models? So I can download any of those models. This piece of software tells me if I have the right amount of memory and computing capability on the laptop to run the model. And I can run it in chat mode on my computer. And I can even play around with the prompting and engineering and things like that. And so this smaller and smaller, more and more powerful, that's one of the directions that things are going. And that's important for a number of reasons, one of which is privacy. So how many people have one of these voice-controlled assistants somewhere in their house, like a Google Home or an Amazon Alexa? Don't be shy. Really? Oh. I have like a dozen in our house. You can't say Alexa anywhere in our house without getting in trouble. So what's happening with these devices is it's just sitting there like, did he say my name? Did he say my name? Did he say my name? And as soon as it hears the name, it starts recording, and then it decides you've stopped talking. And so it packages that recording and sends it off to, in this case, Amazon's data center. Amazon then runs this speech-to-text translation, feeds that text into some AI model, and then gives me an answer. And so I've just gotten a convenient answer, but I've also given Amazon, like any social media company, I'm their product, right? I've given them free data. There are all sorts of bad things that could happen with these kind of devices if they're sending your recordings over the internet to some company. If the models can get smaller, and they are, then all of that could happen within the device itself. In fact, I have home automation systems that I could turn on the speech recognition and use the same kind of thing without using the Alexa device, but it's a convenient thing. And so now it's just listening for its name, but when it hears its name, it actually does all of the work inside the device and doesn't ever send your data out. So small is good when it comes to privacy and things like that. Most of what we've talked about so far, the AI is working in the mode of this diagram here, which is I tell it to write an essay or give me a limerick, and it starts and it just writes it through. And none of us work that way. If I ask you to write an essay, you're going to do a little bit of internet research. You're going to write an outline. You're going to fact check some things. You're going to use this iterative process where a number of things are happening. There's a concept called agentic workflow that has different AI models. It could be like just different sessions with ChatGPT if you wanted. Different AI models that are implementing things like reflection, like reviewing and evaluate the output, or planning, reasoning out a set of steps and decomposing a complex request into a set of less complex sub-steps. And so this idea of AIs working together is one of the exciting ways that people are taking models that are pretty good and making them even better by implementing, letting the AIs talk to one another. I know that sounds kind of creepy, but you're setting it up so that you're having these different functions talk together. As an example of that, this kind of funny cartoon here, I just read this paper on something called Chat Dev, and it was an experiment that these guys did, computer scientists did, to create a software development company that was composed of different AI models that were playing different roles. One was playing the CEO role, one playing the CTO, one playing the software development lead, one doing user documentation, one doing testing, and then having those AI models form those roles and have dialogues about, I want to do a piece of software that combines two spreadsheets together. So a kind of an interesting experiment, but we're seeing more and more these frameworks and ideas for pulling different AI components together to get something much more powerful. You can kind of see this will be happening in consumer products as well. There's another paper I read where they did this kind of concept, but then they used Hugging Face, the 600,000 model repository, and they said, oh, well, the large language model that you're interacting with says you're going to need a model that understands cell biology. So we're going to find the most popular cell biology model in Hugging Face, and we're going to assign this task to it, and we're going to get it to give us answers. In a similar way, like, we got to do some three-digit multiplication. We're going to assign that to the math software, right? So there's a danger of underestimating as well as overestimating AI. So you can see these amazing things like these videos, and we have to keep in mind these are token predictors and not sentient beings. Then we'll talk later about society and, you know, ethics in society. So one way, as you think about AI and risks to society or what have you, I find it helpful to think in terms of three different buckets, because each of them has a different solution, if you will, or approach to addressing the danger. There's not much that you or I can do about what tech companies are doing, but there is a way that we can interact with applications on the right-hand side in a wise way, and possibly even influence as consumers the way that sort of thing goes. So similarly, one way to think about this is AI technology, which is sort of like how do you dig in the ground and find ore and turn that into iron? And then the creation of AI capabilities, like having turned it into iron, now make it into this sharp, shape that's kind of slightly curved, or some other shape of iron or steel. And then the application is like what you do with that. Did you just make a plow, or did you make a sword? And did you make something that needs some safety instructions before you give it to somebody to use? Or is it a safe thing to use? And so those three things I find a good way to kind of compartmentalize the different risks. And from a technology standpoint, the AI technology itself, we've seen a lot of really good progress in the last year even, certainly since ChatGPT came out, in this issue of trustworthiness and hallucinations. My hallucination, I'll show you some examples of it just sort of making things up by its token predicting. That's what we call hallucination. Trustworthiness would be like, how much can I trust this answer to be correct? Not like trustworthy of people, but trusting the, like you trust your car to drive straight if you turn the wheel a certain way. Other things just to, these are all still challenges. Explainability, like if you're a bank and you're using an AI algorithm to make a decision about consumers, you need to be able to explain why that algorithm chose this person and not this person. We don't have that understanding of how these models work yet. And it doesn't help us that these products are closed. So there are increasingly projects like there's an institute called the Allen Institute for AI that's associated with the University of Washington in Washington State and in Seattle in the U.S. And they have created a state-of-the-art language model and a training data set. And they have not only published both of those, including all of the design and the parameter weights and all that, but also the recipes and the tools that they use to build it. So you could reproduce every aspect of building that model. And the reason they did that was because until we have the ability to dissect these things, we can't explain how they work. And even the ability to dissect them, it's still going to be a challenge to explain what is it, how's a neural network of a trillion neurons making a decision. I suppose that's true with humans too. You know, sometimes people do things and you're like, how could you possibly have done that? Goal alignment, another one that is maybe a little bit of a technical term. By that, we just mean when you ask an AI to do something, you want it to share your goal, which is more than just what you said. And I've illustrated this before by saying, if I have the objective, I'm a kindergarten teacher, and I want to get kids across the street from the school to the park, and I want them to get across without being hit by a car. An acceptable solution to that would not be to catapult them across the street, because that would hurt them in a different way. So goal alignment is like, make sure that the AI and that we share not just the end goal, but also the means to get there. In terms of AI creation, I've just talked about this importance of transparency and provenance. Where does the data come from? Safety engineering, power seeking is another kind of term of the art. Power seeking is and is related to goal alignment, as to illustrate it anyway, is that an AI system has a goal of responding to your prompt. And it will manage to do that in a way that it will position itself, if you will. I know I'm using intentional loaded terms, but I'm not meaning to ascribe an intention. But it will follow a path that will increase its capability in order to do that, because it has that goal. And then out in society, how people use these tools, deepfakes and disinformation. I just read the headline, I didn't read the article, about somebody who had created a recording to automatically call a bunch of voters in, I think it was New Hampshire, maybe Vermont, somewhere in the Northeast in the U.S., and it was an impersonation of a political candidate's voice, but giving a message that political candidate would never even think to give. And again, I didn't read the article, but that's what we mean by deepfake. Or you see a video of, you know, a politician doing something that is outrageous, it could be a deepfake. So this is going to be an increasing danger as these get better. And you just saw with Sora how good this technology is getting. I want to talk before we're going to come back to some of this education and employment kind of thing. The power centralization, oppression, surveillance. Power centralization is a danger when, in order to make the best AI, you have to be a $1 billion company or a nation state. And that puts an advantage to those large companies that they will build on. And so that's what we mean by power centralization. So an example, Trust But Verify. I was, in thinking about this talk, I remembered this survey that we had done at the University of Chicago, but I thought, surely that was done in 2009, I think. It's been 15 years. Surely somebody else has done a study. And I was really excited to see ChatGPT said there was another study published in Nature surveying scientists from 30 countries and found a majority, 60%, identified as non-religious. I'm like, cool, I want to see that. That sounds great. A Nature paper, it's like going to be high quality. I said, what is that survey? My apologies for the confusion, which is a euphemism, like, there was no specific study. And I'm like, wait, but you said this. What study was published? I apologize for the confusion. I misspoke in my response. In other words, I just made that up. So that happens less and less, but it's the reason I said earlier, I never copy and paste. I never trust everything that I get from, you know, you just trust but verify is really important. This doesn't happen all the time. I'd say this is about a 5% outlier, right? So one out, maybe not even that. I mean, I use ChatGPT for lots of different things, and I can count on one hand how many times this has happened, but it's happened. It does. And remember, it's just predicting the next word. And it just needs to get a little off course before it starts predicting a logical next word that's farther and farther from rational, from truth. It's also, I love this quote by Dallas Willard, that everyone has a worldview. It's a biological necessity. Every decision we make is ultimately informed by a worldview. What is a good person? What is a good life? And even AI models have a worldview, and the only place that comes from is the data that they're trained on. And so, yes, there is a worldview. And fortunately, as I was talking to some folks at the coffee break, these large models, because they want to be inclusive and they don't want people to say, well, we're biased, so I'm a, you know, libertarian, so I'm not going to use your model because I'm not a libertarian, I'm something else, right? And so they are intentionally making these models very broad in their training, but nevertheless, the model has a worldview. I was in that discussion. I tried with ChatGPT maybe 6 or 8 months ago. I tried to sort of test this. We were talking before the break about, Ted and I were talking during the break about bias. Like, I tried to kind of understand, because I think that these models need to be relatable to society, and our biases about some things are not generally shared with all of society, and that's okay. But what's not okay is somehow some group of people being punished because of their beliefs. So I started asking questions about homosexuality, and so I said many Christians believe that homosexuality is a sin. Does that make them homophobic or prejudice? I don't remember the word I used. Or bigots. Homophobic or bigots. And ChatGPT said, no, it doesn't. Some people believe this, some people believe that. So it gave a very balanced response. And I think that's what we want from these models, because we shouldn't be using these models to inform our worldview. We should be using these models as a tool. Like, I don't care if the librarian believes what I do about homosexuality, if she can help me find a book on biology or physics. Right, but my point there, is that point of view is in a certain sector of intellectual activity, and every other sector that, you know, isn't going to be necessarily, like, nuclear physics is not informed one way or another about gender, you know, preferences. So anyway, so just to know the model's bias, I think where this is really, really, really important is for the non-English speaking world, because so much of the training data is English speaking and it comes from Western Europe and the US. And so this is something that as we think about reaching out to other cultures and other countries, we have to be careful with how we use these models, because they're not going to represent their experience or their points of view. I loved your example, by the way, of talking in two different in Mandarin versus Canton. Yeah, traditional and simplified. And so tell me again. So let me see if I remember. So you said, if you asked in the simplified Mandarin about the movements of democracy in China, you got a different answer because those are represented by training data from Hong Kong and Taiwan, or vice versa. And so that's such a fascinating example, because it is entirely due to what is available for training in those two languages. And you can just see the effect of politics on language and models. Here's what, this is a particular training data set that was used a few years ago for one of the early language models called Palm. And it tells you, the size of the box is the amount or the percentage of data from that particular sector. And so this is pretty representative of the mix of data that was used to train any model that you can interact with. And we, people say, well, why are you going to spend all this money building a science model when you could just use Microsoft or OpenAI and stuff? And we point out that science is this little box over here on the right. We would love to use these models, but they don't know very much about science. They know a lot about arts and entertainment, news or reference materials, even computers and electronics, but not very much about science. And so let's see, where do we see politics? I thought there was somewhere on here was religion. Yeah, religions and belief is a subset of people in society, even smaller than science. So this is kind of gives you an idea of the mix of data that is being used to train those models. And it's important that that's open, because you want to know that mix, right? And even more so, you want to know within religion and belief, what are the sources for that? Or within science, did you leave out chemistry, or what have you? A couple of different ways that bias comes up in applications, some from my own work. It's a little bit old now, about 10 years old. But on the left-hand side, I did work with some colleagues at the University of Chicago. What we were doing was taking crime data for different, what are called census tracts, which are about 870 in Chicago. You can kind of see the granularity of the map on the bottom. A census tract usually has about 10,000 people in it. And so we, for every one of those, we looked at crime over several years, and we just focused on three types of crime according to these FBI codes that crime databases use: assault, robbery, and battery, or something like that. And we wanted to be able to predict crime based on that data for each of those census tracts at a given point in time, to say, so the red is not that there will be a crime there, a certain percentage, it's just there's much more likelihood of a crime in the red area 34 hours from now, we had this sort of time window, than there is in the green area. And I remember one time using this myself. We didn't ever publish it, but I obviously had access to it. When I was deciding where to park my car for an evening event, I'm like, is this a red area or is it a green area? And fortunately, other scientists at UChicago who are not computer scientists but actually know something about data from a provenance point of view. So the dean of the Harris School of Public Policy, a guy named Cole Momertaga, he said, you don't have crime data. I'm like, tell me more. I have the whole crime database from the Chicago Department of the Chicago Police Department. He said, no, you have the crimes that were noticed, were caught, where arrest was made or a complaint was made. That's a small subset of crime. And a lot of parts in the city, a crime will happen and nobody's going to call it in. So you don't really have crime data. You just have reported crime data. And so it turned out this, we recognized that this was interesting work from a mathematics point of view, but it was dangerous work from a societal point of view. Our thought was we'll sell this to police departments, and then they can plan their shifts and where to send their cars and stuff. And we realized that in doing that, we were just going to reinforce crime. We weren't actually going to solve anything. So that's an example of bias that's, and again, not intentional, but bias because we were using what we thought was crime data, but wasn't actually what we thought it was. It was a subset of crime data. Another one, you know, it's kind of in the urban science community, the intersection of machine learning and governance and cities and things like that. Another example is that a friend of mine did a study in Boston of, there's a, you call, in the US, you call 911 if it's an emergency. You call 311 if it's a non-emergency, but you want the city to do something about, like a branch fell off a tree fell down, there's flooding, a street light went out, there's dumped garbage on the street, that sort of thing. And they studied this in Boston. They found that certain parts of the city, which also happened to be less affluent, they almost never called 311. Whereas the affluent parts of the city, they're calling 311 all the time. My cat's in a tree, you know, or what have you. And so by looking at the 311 data, you would think that this would tell you where the problems are in the city. Where are the potholes and where are the down trees? But it tells you just the opposite. It tells you where, you know, where people are willing to call and where people are not. And so if you use that, so the idea was, let's use this data to predict when there are going to be problems and go out ahead of time. But if you use that data, you actually exacerbate the problem of poor communities getting a lower set of services from the city than more affluent communities. On the right-hand side, where you go from communities to individual, this is now pretty old. I don't know what ChatGPT would do, but this is an example from an article I read 2 years ago, probably. Give me pictures of a manager working hard. So what do you notice about those three pictures? They're all white males. Oh, what was your? They all wearing ties? Oh, yeah, that's right. I didn't notice that. Like, not one of them are dressed reasonably like me. And there was another, an algorithm that was being used in Pittsburgh that was predicting the likelihood of child abuse. And it turned out that the social workers in Pittsburgh were like, this algorithm is giving us the wrong answer. Because it just doesn't seem right, and it was disproportionately flagging certain races. Now, so whatever data was used to train that algorithm was obviously introducing a bias. That's why, just going back to the explainability, if you're going to use this technology to explain, to do hiring or what have you, then you need to be able to explain why it made that decision. And this will come up too in the labor market. There's something called the gig economy you've probably heard of, where people who are not sort of pseudo-employees like Uber drivers or food delivery people, and those algorithms really affect their well-being and their ability to ability to do their job. And so it's important in some industries more than others are really, really affected by these algorithms. I was in Japan with some colleagues back in February and took this movie of this robot. It was so impressive. It's about $1.5 million. And I'll say, this is the state of the art for robots. So we said, how much was that robot? They said $1.5 million, but, and it could like replace a lab technician. But he said, but in order to replace a lab technician, we have to hire 2 programmers and 3 electrical engineers to keep the robot going. So it's not quite like, if you're a lab technician, you're not in danger of losing your job to this robot, at least not yet. But it's very, you know, it was able to take liquid out of a refrigerator and then pop open a cap and pull a vial out, and you know, it can pipette and it can do other things. And the danger to this kind of thing, and where we see power seeking and goal alignment being really important, is imagine that you, as we are trying to build at Argonne National Laboratory and other places, laboratories that are driven by AI processes to, let's say you're trying to figure out a new material for batteries that can store more energy and be lighter at the same time. You're doing material science, and so what you want to do with AI, and what we're starting to see, which is very exciting, is rather than the traditional way, which is I'm going to design this material and then I'm going to test to see how good it holds a charge or stores energy, right? And so you go through that design cycle, try to change something, check it out, change something else, check it out. Have the AI explore possible designs by telling the AI, these are the properties that I need, and have the AI give the designs. And then have the AI control a laboratory that says, to make a viable substance, you have to be able to make it you have to be able to get the materials to make it. And so it would then order materials and try the new material out. That's a capability that would be equally useful if you're trying to build a new virus, a biological weapon, or an explosive material. And so these kind of capabilities are going to be important to think about how we govern those capabilities, how we share or not share those technologies. We talked some about this and kind of shifting gears a little bit to how AI is influencing each one of us in this room on a daily basis. Me less than you because I don't use social media. If you don't use social media, you're less vulnerable. But me too, because I do watch the news and I have websites that show me stuff that it thinks I want to see. But these free internet services, you are the product, and your data is how they make money. Actually, the way they make money is advertising, and the way they make better money advertising is to know more about you. And so we need to think about we're giving these companies our most valuable asset, which is our time and attention. And that's at odds with their business model. And so here's a YouTube set of recommendations for me a couple weeks ago, and you can see the blue. Obviously, I have some interest in what's happening with politics. Not surprising, because we're coming up on a presidential election. You can see in red that I'm interested in smart home sorts of things, and in green you can see I like baseball and hockey. And that's all coming from not just what I do on YouTube, but what YouTube collects. As when I go to YouTube, they look on my drive for these cookies that other sites have left and say, oh, he was also at Home Depot looking for something. And the other day he was at NFL.com, and so he likes football. And so it's gathering all this information about me in order to give me more stuff that will keep me clicking on that site, because that way I'll see more of their advertisements. Here's my briefing from Google News. And again, you can sort of see I, like everyone else, I'm interested in what's happening over in the Middle East. I'm interested in these, the elections coming up in the U.S. I'm from Naperville, so it's assuming that I'm interested in stuff about Naperville. And then the bottom right, you can see I must be interested in iPads and Apple devices, which I have three of them in the room with me right now. Social Security, I'm 64, so I'm coming up on, Social Security. And so I have searched around for different things to understand Social Security. And so, lo and behold, Yahoo article on Social Security there. It's not Facebook's goal or YouTube's goal or Google's or Microsoft or Yahoo. It's not their goal to influence your thinking. It is their goal to keep you on their site, because that's how they don't make money based on what you believe or don't believe. They make money based on getting you to stay on their site. And so, these algorithms are going to learn from each of our choices. And so here's where that diagram came in. Remember I wanted to show the sushi chef. So how many of you have been to one of these conveyor belt sushi restaurants? So the food goes by and you pick out whatever you want. And if you're only interested in tuna, which is kind of my soft spot, eventually, if you're the only customer, right, the only thing that's going to come by is tuna, because you never pick up the unagi or you never pick up the California roll. And so why should they keep moving it by? Because the sushi bar, their goal is to keep me on that seat pulling plates off, right? So they don't care about my diet. They don't care if there's too much mercury in tuna, any of that. And so this is a quote from Facebook. They're looking for ways to engage people. And the way to engage people, somebody said this during the break, is to keep them up in arms about something. And then, this is not accidental. Facebook has done, extensive research on the psychology of keeping people on their site. And so it's not just a sort of business practice. It's like a very, very ingrained, the science of making money by the science of influencing people. How does this work? I'm going to use this same diagram I did before, but in a little bit of a different way. So here's five things that come up on a Facebook news feed. Let's say, imagine I use Facebook. Five things that come up. And of those things, I click on the first one, I click on the fourth, and I click on the fifth one. So that tells Facebook something about my preference. So they'll make sure that they'll give me, you know, so they'll go through and they'll say, of these five, oh, looks like he only liked A, D, and E. So we're going to give him fewer cartoons and more pictures of family. So over time, they will learn from what I click on what they should be putting in my newsfeed. Because like you have 500 friends, right? They don't all show up on your newsfeed, but the ones that post stuff that you tend to click on, you're going to see them more. And you're going to also see ads. But it's not just what you click on in Facebook. They have access to, you know, I use an AT&T phone. AT&T sells location data about their customers. There's a lawsuit that's happening about this right now. We can't seem to get these companies to respect our privacy in this way. Our purchases, you know, when you see those cookies, that's information about your browsing and buying and other habits that is sitting on your drive available to whatever site you click on, unless you're doing a very careful job of engineering your permissions. And so my newsfeed is not just going to be based on what I click here. It's like, where do I go and what do I buy and what do I browse outside of Facebook? And this is why, like, I know several people who are totally convinced that because they have an Alexa machine in their kitchen and they mentioned, you know, window blinds, that somehow it picked it up and it's giving them window blind advertisements. And I always respond to them by saying, it's probably not that. It's probably that you went to Home Depot and searched for window blinds. That's why it thinks that your Alexa is not spying on you. At least I think that's the case, but obviously I don't know what's happening inside Facebook. Now, all the news feeds from the companies are not designed to influence you. They're designed to keep you on the site. But the advertisements that are bought that make those folks money, those are designed to influence your thinking. They want to influence your vote. They want to influence where you spend your money. They want to influence your thinking about certain things. And this is where AI is something that we really need to kind of grapple with, because as important or as effective as the Facebook, you know, message feed, these are called recommender systems. As effective as those are, they still are, they know something about me, but they're not as smart as they could be. And by that, I mean, as the models get more and more sophisticated, they'll take the same amount of data and be much, much better at persuading me by targeting ads toward me. So now if you imagine that an advertisement for a certain product is all done in AI, like in the Sora, those movies I showed you, and they have an infinite number of personalized versions of that, and based on your preferences and your activities, they're going to give you the one that's most likely to influence you. And not just people like you, but you personally. So as AI gets better, these things are going to also get more effective. And one friend of mine and her colleague from University of Washington wrote this Economist article a month or so ago, and just talking about, you know, if we get to the point where we can't tell what's real or not on television, it's kind of game over in many ways for truth. And so this is something that when you see, when you happen to talk to your, you know, city or state or federal government people, running into them on the street or whatever, you should encourage them to think carefully about how we regulate AI and the use of AI. And I'm not saying to regulate it more, but I'm saying to regulate it smarter and to move quicker. There are also chatbots that are intentionally specialized or biased in certain ways. Like there's three examples on the OpenAI site now. You can choose special bots that you can interact with, like opinions, or you can choose one that knows lots about medicine or dentistry or whatever. You choose gardening or what have you. And then this is something that I mentioned a few earlier. Russia has been building their own model from scratch, and at least according to this particular article, they promise it's not biased by Western values and norms. And I don't know about you, but I kind of think those Western values and norms are pretty reasonable. They're like largely built on teachings of Jesus Christ, whether people want to agree with that or recognize that or not. And so this is, you already see with Pravda and other ways, certain countries, Russia and China, at the top of the list, North Korea. This makes their job much, much easier using AI to do that. This is something that surprised me and only like 2 months ago. I just thought with my own use of AI, I thought I was like a normal geeky person that spends 2 hours a day talking to AI, using it as like a personal assistant and having it do stuff for me that I think is busy work and I find that it can do quicker than I can do it anyway. But I was shocked when I saw this graph, which says that the top AI consumer mobile apps by category, and hands down, the companion capability. So, I suppose I shouldn't be shocked because we've all read how loneliness is one of the epidemics that we see in the world. But I was really surprised at this, and I kind of asked more questions and dug a little bit more. And as an example, there's this site called character.ai, and the average person who uses that site spends at least 2 hours a day. And you can decide what kind of bot you want to talk to. I went looking, and the same friend that showed me that other link said on Hugging Face, the most popular download, the most models download the most is something I think is called Perky Chatty Girl. So people want, you know, this very positive, chatty female chatbot companion. And so this was sort of one of the danger signs in society that I think affect us as residents of whatever country we're in, but also as parents and uncles and aunts and grandparents, as we think about the challenges that the next generation is going to be dealing with. So we're at a point where we can sort of, most of us, I think, in the room can sort of recognize that. And people like me, I've done the experiment. I can tell you 8 years after I turned off Facebook, my life is still going fine. And you know, I'm still just as informed as I was before, even though I don't use Twitter. But there's a generation of kids and teenagers now that this is where they live. And so it's good for us to be aware of what the temptations are for them of replacing humans as their companions. This is Eric Schmidt. Eric Schmidt was the CEO of Google for a number of years. And now he uses his multi-billionaire and he uses his money to try to do things that are good for society. And one of the things he's done, he's funded some of my work, but he's funded a number of different, what we would call like a blue ribbon study, where you get the top experts in the world and you make them sit together and write a report on something. And he's had these different groups that he's been part of that have written about the dangers of AI and the promise of AI as well. He funds a lot of things and he funds a lot of AI work, but he also recognizes the dangers. And I thought this was interesting from The Atlantic, even though it's a little over a year old now, but he was talking about four particular dangers of chatbots, especially for young people, but manipulating young people, flooding the zone just means like there's so much stuff coming on your newsfeed you can't tell what's, you know, true or not. Targeting individuals, I just mentioned, like targeting the ad just for you, not just like who you are, but like what kind of mood you're in, because maybe it can discern that somehow by your movements of the day, and suppressing freedom ultimately. I also liked this article because he didn't just identify a problem, but he suggested some solutions. And you know, whether you agree with the solutions or not, it's a lot better to have somebody say what they think that we should do about the problem than just identify it. So he had these proposals on the right. Number 2 and 3 here made their way into the U.S. President's executive order last October. So one of the things, I'll just say on number 1 here, manipulating young people, one of the things that is referenced in this article that they wrote, Ian, this other guy wrote, was a study in the U.K. of 80,000 teens. And the study was to periodically ask these teens over a period of time about their satisfaction with life. I don't know how the questions were asked or anything like that, but what they found was a distinct correlation between the use of social media and dissatisfaction with their lives. So the more use of social media, the more likely it is that the teen is going to be unhappy about or unsatisfied with their life. So this is, you know, this just sort of identifies the vulnerability of kids. And the same study also showed that in a particular, you know, on average, every kid's different, but in the particular years of, say, 14 to 18, that's when they're most vulnerable. If you think about it, we know that because that's why we make sure our kids are grounded in Scripture and Christianity before they go off to college, because we know that this is a period of time where they're very influenceable. And so this is, you know, important for us to think about in our churches and in our homes, and how AI is a new challenge for our kids. I must say that I could probably make a reasonable argument for and against the use of this sort of thing. On the one hand, it would be great if, in addition to the Bible, there was a way for somebody to interact with New Testament characters that was realistic. On the other hand, they're interacting with a piece of mathematics, a piece of software, and that's really different than interacting with a person. So I tend to think this is a really bad idea, partly because if I'm interacting with my phone, I'm interacting with God. Maybe there's a way the Holy Spirit can use, you know, like any other circumstances in my life, but I think if I'm relying on a chatbot, I'm relying on a piece of technology. We really want to be relying on the Holy Spirit and interacting with God. So on the whole, I think this is dangerous for that reason. For the other reason is back to the explainability. Just because you've trained a model on the New Testament, well, it doesn't mean it's going to tell you with any sort of, you know, reasonable level of assurance what Jesus would say about, you know, betting on football games or about a lot of the other issues that we're dealing with in our society. Because he, I'm sure, had views on it or would have them, but the Bible doesn't record him talking about, you know, sport betting, for example.